Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
the Elm Street Group at Morgan Stanley, working with clients to create enduring financial value and a lasting impact through sustainable investing solutions. A local wealth management team with global insights. Find out more at the Elm Street Group at morganstanley.com.
And by Antioch University New England, offering doctoral degrees in clinical psychology, environmental studies, and marriage and family therapy, as well as master's degrees and certificates. antioch.edu/nhradio.
And from Dartmouth Hitchcock, imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community. With convenient locations throughout northern New England, world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. More than 40 years ago, a new law changed the world for young people with disabilities. It was called the Education for All Handicapped Children's Act, passed in 1975. And it said that all kids had the right to a free, appropriate public education, and that the federal government should assist state and local governments in providing this. It sounded great on paper, and on the ground in New Hampshire, some communities have been able to meet the Act's goals, while others have not. Money's often a hurdle, and Congress has never fully funded its promised share. So where do we stand now on special education? That's what we're asking today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. With me in studio is Bonnie Dunham. She's Associate Project Director at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center on Special Education. Bonnie, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Michael McSheehan, Project Director at the UNH on Disability and Center on Inclusive Education. And Michael, welcome. Good to see you, too.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Santina Thibodeau, New Hampshire's State Director of Special Education. She's also President of the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. And Santina, welcome back. Thank you for your time.
Glad to be invited.
Well, Santina, all of you, but Santina, to you first, what's the number one misunderstanding that you face about the field you work in and the kids that you work for?
I think there's quite often a lot of misperceptions. One of the misperceptions is that if you are a student who's been identified with a disability, then in fact your schooling may be done down the hall and not in the typical classroom. Another misconception is quite often that students with disabilities will not go on to college or any type of full-time employment, and that's simply not true.
So down the hall, apart from everybody else, this is part of this whole inclusive effort that you have been making at the state level and also at the UNH and Student Disability.
Yes, yes. It's called inclusive education. And one of the requirements that state agencies have to do is we have to monitor the amount of time that students spend in the general classroom. And I'm very happy to report that New Hampshire does have a high inclusive rate. And that's really based on all of the work that not only the Institute on Disability does, but the Parent Information Center, as well as the Bureau of Special Education.
So two misconceptions that you face all the time, even after all these years. Mm-hmm. One is if you're in special education, you're down the hall, as you put it. And the other is that you're not going to college. How about you, Michael? What are some of the misunderstandings or myths that you confront day after day?
Sure. I would say that the same two come up for my work that Santina has mentioned. An expectation that we're going to start in a separate special place, that the special place is the better place for instruction of kids with disabilities, when in fact, good teaching is good teaching. And so we want to kind of start with that conversation first. I would extend what Santina has said about going to college to a conversation about expectations. So often there's a presumption that a student with a disability somehow is not going to achieve at the same level as a child without a disability. which is just a disservice to start at that low bar. We want to raise that bar up. And I think that when teachers and family members see students responding to their high expectations, they meet them. So I think a misunderstanding in the past has been that a child with a disability, even a child with a significant disability, can't achieve academically, behaviorally, socially in a school. And we can go over that.
Well, a little bit later, we'll talk about what it takes to do that. When we talk about disability, Michael, what's the range of disabilities that we're talking about?
Well, we may be talking about somebody who has what's perceived as maybe a mild learning disability, a specific learning disability. I have a specific issue with reading, or I have a specific issue in learning math. Speech and language impairments, children who have labels that we're familiar with now in the media, autism, Down syndrome, children with intellectual disabilities, some kind of cognitive disability, and not only developmental disabilities, but also children who acquire disabilities. So a student who experiences a traumatic brain injury, for example, may be the range of the population that we're talking about.
So a wide range.
Very wide range.
What do you think, Bonnie, about this field and some of the, well, just the funny questions that you get?
One of the things that I see as happening out in the communities are that some people consider special education to be a favor, something that we do to help those poor children who have disabilities, and it really minimizes the contributions that people with disabilities make. With good special education, children can grow up and be successful, can be contributing members of their community, and have valued roles. But if they're dismissed, then it really does everybody a disservice. I think the richness and diversity of the school community benefits when it consists of all kinds of children, and you can't be prepared for the real world unless you go to school with children who make up that broad population. My son, who does have Down syndrome and a number of other disabilities, was almost exclusively educated in general education settings. His needs are pretty significant, but he was prepared to be a member of the community. He's been working at Wendy's for 17 years now, and he lives, works, and plays in Merrimack, where we live, and he has a great life. But it wouldn't have been the same if not for his involvement in that general education community. And all of that was based on the work of families and educators who came generations before us.
Well, and let's talk about that for just a second. That's an important point. Don't dismiss him, and that's a powerful statement. If he had been born, 10 or 20 years earlier, prior to 1975, what might his experience have been, Bonnie?
I think we would have had to have fought harder just to keep him in our home. Parents at that time, 10 years before he was born, were encouraged to place their children in institutions. The thought of that horrifies me, that he would have just had his life taken away, wouldn't have been able to make choices, wouldn't have been able to make friends, to just enjoy singing karaoke. That's one of his favorite things to do. And the people that he spends time with wouldn't have gotten to know him. And so it would have been a disservice both ways. I think that I'm especially proud to live in New Hampshire, where we were the first state to close our institution. And once that institution was closed, it meant that we had to start preparing children with disabilities to live in the real world, because that was the only game in town.
So not just he would have lost the ability to live that full, rich life that you described, but the people he works with, the people that he sings with, would have also lost that, that gift of being with him.
Right.
You wanted to jump in, Santina. Go ahead.
I did. The other piece that often people don't realize is that special education is from ages 3 through 21. So we often have to remember that students who are preschoolers, those 3 through 5-year-olds, are eligible, if they do have a disability, to receive services so that by the time they enter into our school system, they'll have the tools that they need to be successful.
Go ahead, Michael.
I wanted to add, based on what I heard you talking about, Bonnie, that I think at the heart of special education is civil rights legislation. And that should not go understated, that this is not just about providing a therapy to a child in a school, but it's about having the right to attend your neighborhood school. In 1975, when the first law was passed, we had more than 1 million children with disabilities across our country who were not even going to any school. They were at home with their families. They were in some other hidden away place. And the movement in special education began as a civil rights movement. And so keeping that heart of the conversation is really important.
Well, at the ground level, there are challenges that come up. And I wonder, Santina, to you first, how you feel when people say, you know, that's great and it's compelling to hear Bonnie's story, but it takes resources to integrate fully. It's distracting for the other kids when somebody's acting out in a class. Sometimes in a small town, a few families with special education needs will move in. It gets expensive for the local budget. So there's this feeling sometimes that, you know, this is hard to achieve.
Mm-hmm. Part of what the Bureau of Special Ed does is we have a lot of resources that we provide to our school districts. One of the resources we have now is a project called Universal Design for Learning. And that's a structure that we can offer to any school or school district, and it really provides the principles for good teaching. I think Michael had mentioned that before. And that good teaching is giving the classroom teacher the tools to be able to structure the classroom so that it can meet the various needs. So maybe a student needs to think about their writing may be difficult, so maybe they need to express their ideas through a video. And that's the way that they can be engaged. So we're constantly thinking about how to support the classroom teacher so that they feel that they have the tools. And the benefit is that every student in that classroom is benefiting. And then Bonnie had talked about earlier, having diversity in the classroom benefits every student and it benefits the schools.
Go ahead, Bonnie, and then Michael. Yeah, love your thoughts on that, because sometimes this is portrayed as a, you know, us versus them.
Well, I have two things. One is that there's a saying that disability is the only minority that you can join. And so there are some people who say, oh, why are we educating those children? And suddenly when someone in their family or in their circle of friends becomes or has a child with a disability, their thoughts change. And I think the children who are going to school now are going to have entirely different points of view than people from generations past, because they see the value, they get the point. And while it can be expensive to provide special education, it can be expensive to have a football team. It can be expensive to do lots of other things, but we don't stop doing them. We look for resources to do them. And the other thing is that not educating children with disabilities is way more expensive than providing special education. Children who are ill-prepared to become taxpayers, who do not graduate from high school, are going to be in the long run much more expensive than children who get a high-quality education.
Well, again, the story of your son, instead of being in an institution, which is what would have happened 40 years ago, he's out working and doing and probably taxpaying from that Wendy's paycheck.
He's probably the only person I know who is thrilled to pay taxes.
Go ahead, Michael.
That notion that children without disabilities are somehow going to lose out if a child with a disability is in their class actually doesn't pan out from the research perspective. In all the studies, and there's been quite a few studies over the last 30 years that have looked at this really important question, is there a negative effect on kids without disabilities? And in fact, we see the opposite in the research findings. When implemented well with a school-wide approach, inclusive education results in higher academic social-emotional learning for kids without disabilities as well. And that value to all of the students in a neighborhood school can't always be captured in the research. That said, I want to acknowledge that if any classroom teacher is poorly supported, isn't given ongoing professional learning, isn't given the resources they need for their classroom that is sitting in front of them, the natural diversity that occurs in any given neighborhood, there's going to be struggles.
In some districts you hear about, you know, 30 kids to a class, and that's a lot, you know, no matter who's sitting there.
Right. So you put a student with a disability in that class, a teacher that's poorly supported, people's attention may go to the kid with the disability as the cause of the struggles within that classroom. And we need to step back and refocus to say, well, that student actually may just be the canary in the coal mine that's letting us see that something else isn't working within the system. And so let's pay attention to that.
Let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. And Wayne is calling in. Hi, Wayne. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, this is Representative Wayne Burton. I just wanted to make 2 points. First, New Hampshire almost sunsetted special ed out of existence in 1985. Right after deinstitutionalization, we had a sunset law, and that office recommended it be done away with because feds cannot require it. The states only need to have it for the money. But there was a wonderful moment when the Democrats and Republicans joined together with then-Governor John Sununu to rewrite the special ed law over the course of the year, and it was a marvelous experience. The second point I would make is, for 3 years ago, I was head of the Community College Consortium on Autism and Intellectual Disabilities. Half the students who come out of public school, high schools now on IEPs go to community colleges, yet there's no special ed law for higher education, and that is absolutely where we need to go. The pilot program we did in California had an 85% placement rate out of the special program that the community college out there.
That's interesting. So working with the community colleges, Wayne, with kids who had special needs coming out of the high school, very interesting. And we hadn't talked about higher education. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Before we talked about higher education, when he mentioned revising our special education laws, I just want to say that in New Hampshire, when we do that, it's pretty unique in that the Bureau of Special Education brings in stakeholders. They bring in family members. They bring in educators and administrators and legislators and all kinds of people to sit down and have a conversation about what's working, what could be done better, how can we make sure that the real point of the law is being upheld, and that we're addressing any concerns that have come up, any pieces that have not been working well. And so every few years the law is revised, and it's done in a way that is very nice in New Hampshire that really listens to all of the voices.
Michael, go ahead.
Wayne, I want to thank you for your comment and your question regarding students with disabilities going on to college. That has been a wonderful thrust and extension of our work in the field of special education. And while we still have very low overall graduation rates nationally for kids with disabilities from public schools, we are having an increase in students with disabilities going on to college, community college, universities, and there's actually now specific projects, and I believe every state now has a link to the Think College project. And Think College's effort is to focus on kids with more extensive support needs attending colleges and universities. So it's not just students with mild disabilities, but those with more significant disabilities who are also now going on to college.
Speaking of numbers, Santina, I did want to ask you, just again, going back to K through 12, has the percentage of kids needing special education services increased?
Earlier we had talked about the myths. Actually, the number of students with disabilities has been decreasing.
Really?
It has. We have that, earlier I talked about that 3 through 5 year olds or preschoolers. That's the population that's growing for students with disabilities.
Littler kids.
Littler kids, where our school-age students continue to drop down.
That's interesting. So can you attribute that shift to anything?
We often get that question asked. And there is something called a 504 plan. And the 504 plan addresses possibly medical needs or needs that are more life-impacting. So we do have students that needs are better fit by a 504 plan rather than an IEP. We also find as we're doing, as progressive as we are in our state with competency-based education and our non-graded classrooms and the different resources that are entering into the classroom, there may be students whose needs are being met right there in the regular ed classroom and do not need an IEP.
Very interesting. All right, and coming up, we'll talk about what an IEP is and some innovation around that going on in New Hampshire. Also, I'm going to ask all of you how children are identified as needing a special education IEP. All that coming up, plus your questions and comments. Keep them coming. 1-800-892-6477.
When you really dig into history,
images like this one have New Yorkers thinking twice about the consequences of buying Northern Power.
We had lawsuits against Hydro-Quebec, government of Quebec. We were suing everybody.
The more you realize the past is never past. This week, Outside In from NHPR presents the third in our four-part series called Powerline. Learn all about the history of Canadian hydropower wherever you get your podcasts or at outsideinradio.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, where do we stand on special education in New Hampshire? We're looking at what federal and state laws say and the challenges of funding and bureaucracy. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. One more time, that number, 1-800-892-6477. And Bonnie Dunham, Michael McSheehan, and Santina Thibodeau. Let's go right back to our listeners. Kimberly's joining us from Pembroke. Hi, Kimberly. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to call with some observations from my and my son's experience. He's had an IEP since he was 3 years old. We lived in Concord. He went to developmental preschool in Concord, and it was fabulous. He thrived. He progressed wonderfully. And part of, I think part of that is that the Concord School District draws on the expertise of supports like Community Bridges, which is an amazing place as well. We moved a few miles down the road last year. And the differences are striking.
From district to district, Kimberly, there's a variety of resources and so forth available.
Well, just a few miles down the road, we moved, and I've observed that in a smaller community, they seem very ill-equipped to meet the needs of a diverse population. I've noticed with much concern that they want to treat issues that are addressed in his IEP as disciplinary issues. The fact that he might need a little more teacher guidance or a few more minutes working on something is being treated as a disciplinary problem, which really concerns me. This new small community, they don't practice communicating with the parents. They don't want to hear input from the parents. They have flat out refused to go over the IEP with me and told me that I just need to sign it.
Wow.
Disagreements.
Kimberly, I'm so sorry to hear about your struggles. And there's two important points that she raises. One is the idea that, you know, approaches vary district by district. And Santina, do you want to take that one first, that, you know, what happens in Concord may not be what happens in Pembroke and vice versa?
Right. Thank you for your question, Kimberly. So every district may have some uniqueness. They may have a particular project that's going on where another district doesn't. But from your question, I also have heard that you may be going from what we call our preschool program into our school age program. And that transition is often one that parents have to rethink the special ed process because there are really quite some differences. The other piece is that as part of an IEP, there are some students who may require a behavior plan. So that would be something that you could discuss with the IEP team. And a little later, we'll talk about what an IEP is.
And go ahead, Bonnie. I'd love your thoughts on what she experienced district to district, because in addition to telling us your own story, you're at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center, and I'm sure you hear from parents all the time.
We do. And rarely do people call to say things are great. We tend to hear everything that's going wrong. And it varies. And in some districts, I think they have more experience working with certain types of children. They may be a large community and have just done more of that, whereas in a small community, that may be the first child with that type of disability, which isn't always a bad thing, because one of the issues we hear is that the school district doesn't know how to meet my child's needs. The other is that this school district is unwilling to do anything different. They keep saying, this is how that we've always done it. And for a parent who wants to do something out of the box, who wants their child perhaps to be the first one to be fully included in a chemistry class, whereas that school district has never done that before, they may be looking at it from a different angle. And so while there are differences, there are some basic requirements under the law that every school district needs to follow. And sometimes someone slips up on that, and the parent needs to make them aware of that. Parent Information Center offers free workshops, free materials. We have a great website that people can go to get user-friendly information about that. And occasionally when people do make mistakes, we've seen a real positive trend in being willing to find ways to make it right, especially when parents and schools are able to sit down and have that conversation.
Well, something else she said that I want to throw to you, Michael, and Kimberly, again, thank you for calling. She said some of his issues in class are being described as behavior issues, when in fact they're related to his need for a little more time. They're being regarded as disciplinary matters, when in fact she feels they are not. I'm guessing this is pretty common.
It is pretty common. Absolutely common. If you were to ask some of my office mates, they would describe that some of my uniquenesses need a behavior support plan as well. It really, you know, this notion that quality education shifts in New Hampshire from zip code to zip code is not just an issue for kids with disabilities. This is a broader challenge that we experience in the live free or die state, where there's high value for local control. And with that comes the challenge of individual school administrative units, individual districts having to develop and have kind of ongoing professional learning for their educators. This notion that the behavior problem somehow is situated in the child is a shift that is an important change in education, which really started to take hold about 20, 25 years ago. And this notion was that, you know, children behave differently in different environments, with different people, under different tasks or materials that they're working with, that all of those can influence behavior. So, you know, Kimberly, your son or daughter may be showing some different behaviors in this new setting that maybe are not situated in the child, but that this is a new context and the child's trying to figure out this new setting. So as Santina said, we start with figuring out what are the good supports, what's the right constellation of supports for this individual child that will prevent any of the behavioral concerns, and then will teach the child and hopefully the adults and classmates any new skills they would need for this child to be successful. I'd want to add here that, you know, Kimberly's story represents another big issue that I see frequently in the field, and that's this notion of trying to figure out how to include one child at a time, right, which limits, as Bonnie said, based on what your experience is. Well, if I've never supported a child just like this before, I don't know how to do it, which is why in the field we're shifting to more school-wide or district-wide approaches to think about education of kids with disabilities. What are the school-wide or district-wide structures that are shown to be really helpful that we can get in place? Now, that still requires and puts the onus of responsibility back to the district to initiate, implement, and then sustain those new models of education.
And making sure the teachers have the resources that they need, maybe another teacher in the classroom. And, you know, we always talk about training, but I can't tell you how many times on this program we've talked about teachers need to get trained for this, that, and the other thing. I mean, you kind of wonder, when are they going to find time to actually teach? So it's a lot.
Understatement. Huge understatement. You know, this may be, you know, at the heart simple. We can talk about rights and values. That does not make it easy on Monday to figure out.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
For that child who is acting out, one of the key questions is, what is he trying to tell us with those behaviors? And once that question is answered, everyone's life will become easier. Sometimes it's that the work is too hard or too easy, or he's with the wrong group of children. Sometimes children aren't kind to each other, and children without disabilities are sometimes better at being discreet about that acting out. And so the child with the disability may not be acting out any more than the other children. They're just getting caught more often. And so changing that culture of the classroom can do wonders for all of the children.
Thank you again for the call, Kimberly. And again, good luck to you. The number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. It's NHPR Exchange. Here's an email from Kathy in Conway. And this relates to what you said earlier, Bonnie, about, you know, us versus them. But anybody can join the group of people with disabilities at any moment. Kathy says, in 1995, I took a course given by the Parent Information Center designed to help volunteers become advocates for children and their families navigate through the IEP process. Kathy says, I had two beautiful and healthy daughters, age 5 and 3, but wanted to help others. Then in 1997, my daughter had a stroke at age 4. Kathy says, thanks to my training, I was armed with the training and reference books to ensure that she received all of the services she needed. I attended my daughter's IEP meetings with sticky notes on every page that referenced her issues and rights. So, wow, Kathy, thank you for the story and the email. And let's just get into a little bit, Santina, what an IEP is. Mm-hmm. Individualized
education
program.
And yes.
Most people have a sense of what it is, but how is it determined that one kid needs it and one kid does not?
So there is a referral process and an eligibility determination. And if the team, and that team includes a parent, believes that the child is eligible, then the team would go on to develop the IEP. Now, the IEP, and earlier we had talked about every student should have an IEP or possibly a personalized learning plan, but the IEP is really about what are a student's strengths, and we always want to build from that strength. And then if there are some weaknesses or areas that need to either have some services or an accommodation or some supports, that's what would be then put into the IEP. And again, it should be monitored. We always want to see how students are doing. Are they making progress? Should it be tweaked? And then, again, even in that review process, again, the parents are involved. And what we hope is that at a certain age, students are also involved. Because as we had talked about going on to colleges, students need to learn to advocate for themselves and understand how that disability may impact their learning.
A couple emails about IEPs and how they work. Here's a comment from Lauren on Facebook. She says, I'm glad you're having this discussion. Sometimes the kids who need the most help don't qualify for it. Sometimes kids' test scores are misleading. Bonnie, what about that? Have you heard of cases where the parent feels like my kid needs an IEP and the school says, no, he or she is fine?
Yes, I definitely have heard of that. And there are times when at a first glance, the parent may say, oh, my child is acting out in ways that seem to indicate they need an IEP. The school district may say, we don't think so. The answer to that question lies in getting evaluations done. And that's part of the special education process where evaluations are done and they need to be an array of evaluations so that you get that broad perspective. And sometimes a parent may even bring in their own outside evaluations. So then the team can look at all of that information and determine, does the child meet the definition of a child with a disability who needs special education? Or do they have a disability and just need some accommodations, which can happen under Section 504? But it's not does he or doesn't he based on people's just beliefs. It's based on facts and on data that come from evaluations.
How much do you think, Bonnie, or anybody can jump in on this, school districts over-identify kids as needing special education in order to get additional federal funding or for other unknown reasons? What do you think, Bonnie? Do schools over-identify or under-identify?
I have never heard of a school district over-identifying a child with a disability to get money. That seems to be one of the biggest myths out there. While there is some funding provided, it is not enough to entice a school district to find a child eligible. If a child is found eligible for special education, it's because they've been evaluated and they meet that definition. There are times when school districts may be under-identifying children with disabilities because they perhaps aren't following the process as they should, or sometimes may tell a parent, let's wait another year. Let's see if he just matures and develops that skill, which then means a year from now, if the child hasn't developed that skill, they're in even rougher shape than they were a year ago, and the parent is frustrated as well.
This is a big issue, under-identifying, over-identifying. I'm guessing there's arguments on all sides of it. Here's Fred on Twitter who says, all students should have an IEP. Fred says, many kids find IEPs are for the, quote, quoting Fred here, stupid students. Now, what do you think about that, Michael? Is there another side to it that some kids may say, no, mom or dad, don't sign me up for an IEP. I don't want to be one of those kids.
It points to the broader cultural issue that we do have around disability, the stigma that comes with that. Unless we shift the broader conversation about disability and what it actually is or is not, we're going to continue to have children feeling like being identified with a disability is a bad thing, versus being identified actually gets me access to some of the supports and the assistance that will help me thrive locally, which is why I love the notion of personalized learning that's happening within New Hampshire and nationally, the movement toward competency-based education, so that we're identifying each individual child's unique learning needs and addressing those. It's not about who's stupid and who's smart. Let's shift the conversation to, we're all smart in our own little ways. What support do we each need in order to get to the next level?
Is that really possible to have all students, as Fred said, should have an IEP? Because, it sounds great, right? I mean, everybody does learn differently. I remember my own high school career, some classes I did great and others I was, weeping in the back of the room because I didn't get it. So, is that really possible, though, or is that just like somewhere over the rainbow?
I think it's possible. I don't know that I would call it every student having an IEP, because that is specific legal language that has lots of other things that come with it. But this notion that we should be attending to each and every child's unique learning needs is really valuable and important. I'm going to go back to some basic statistics, because this brings us to a broader issue within disability, and that is to also include a conversation about mental health and mental well-being. And in New Hampshire and nationally, we still have a high rate of students with mental health support needs that are going unmet. They're dropping out of school at high rates. 30 to 50% of that population are dropping out of school. Teen suicide, the third leading cause for suicide in New Hampshire among our youth, is mental health being unsupported, unaddressed. And so often that's an invisible disability, quote unquote, in our schools. So again, moving back to this notion of attending to each individual child, we could probably prevent and be proactive in our supports for students if we shift the cultural conversation away from, are you stupid, are you smart, to what are your individual needs and how can we meet those?
Well, Fred, thank you for the comment. What do you think, Santina?
I certainly agree with Michael, and I think one of the things that New Hampshire has done to move that forward for personalized learning is we have something called an extended learning opportunity, referred to in our schools as ELOs. And that's an opportunity where if we have a high schooler who's very interested in American government, rather than sitting in a classroom taking that class, they would be able to go out into the real world with their American government teacher and create what their course is going to look like. And maybe they're going to be at our state house, and maybe they're going to attend a seminar, and they're going to do writing. Again, that's one way that we are moving beyond the classroom so that we can personalize that learning.
Well, got an email from Marjorie responding to Kimberly, who called earlier with her struggle switching school districts. And Marjorie says a properly, legally developed IEP should involve professional and parental, capitalized, involvement, Marjorie says. She says no parent should be handed an IEP and told, as Kimberly reported, that they must sign a document that they had not helped to develop. So Marjorie, thank you for that one. We'll take a lot more of your emails after a short break. The address is exchange@nhpr.org, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, what special education looks like in our schools today, more than 40 years after the federal law that established the right to what it called a free, appropriate public education. Let's get your questions, stories, comments in 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Santina Thibodeau is here. She's New Hampshire's State Director of Special Education and President of the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. Michael McSheehan is with us, Project Director at the UNH Institute on Disability and Center on Inclusive Education. And Bonnie Dunham, Associate Project Director at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center on Special Education. And all of you, here's an email that came in from Jillian, who says, there's a lot of talk about so-called school choice in New Hampshire these days. Do students with disabilities have the same kinds of choices when it comes to charter schools and voucher programs that fund private and religious schools? Can they count on these alternative schools to ensure they get a, quote, free and appropriate public education? Again, that's the quote from the law that set this up, free and appropriate public education. This is a big question. Santina, I'm going to throw it to you first, and anybody else jump in, too.
Sure. So when we think about our charter schools are public schools.
And so they have to take anyone who wants to go.
They have to take, providing that that's parent choice. So the parent says, I'd like my child to not go to the traditional school, but to go to a charter school. And that charter school, in conjunction with the district where the child lives, would implement the IEP. And services could be provided in a variety of ways. And we do have many students who have IEPs who are attending charter schools throughout our state.
So that's an important point, because in the past there were stories about certain charter schools having entrance exams or lotteries or not being too excited to take kids with special education needs. So we don't see that now. They're public schools and they have to take kids who want to go there.
Correct. And actually, just about a year and a half ago, there was a commission on charter schools and special ed students. So the state of New Hampshire studied that issue extensively and submitted a report on that.
Bonnie, go ahead.
Some charter schools still do have lotteries, but they're not to discriminate. If they have more applicants than they can take, then they have a lottery so that it's fair, so that it's not that they pick and choose. It's based on chance.
Sure, sure. They only have 50 seats, and they can't take 60 kids for 50,
right.
50 seats. What are your thoughts on her question, though, about vouchers for, you know, people talking about now using public monies? This has not been approved yet, right, but using public monies for private and religious schools. How does special education and those rights fit into that?
There are a couple of pieces. First, when a child with a disability is placed by his or her parent in a private school, that child no longer has any right to the special education that he or she would have received in the public system. I am concerned that parents don't always know that and may choose to move their child to a private school using a voucher or scholarship, and then find out, oh, my child doesn't have all of the rights that they had. They aren't going to get all of the services that they got in the public schools, and then have a failed experience and go back to the public schools, perhaps having lost some ground and having the public schools have to make up for it. The school districts, I think, will lose some funding, certainly, but also when a child with a disability goes to a private school, the town where that private school is located is responsible for conducting evaluations for that child. They will pay. So whether the child comes from that town or not, that town that houses a private school will bear some extra costs unrelated to children who live in their towns.
If the voucher money, Santina, comes from public dollars, as mm-hmm. is being discussed yet, if it's public dollars, do those public rights and responsibilities come along with it when it comes to special education?
So right now, let's leave our state of New Hampshire and go to our federal legislation. And our federal legislation says that if you are a student with an IEP and your parent places you in a private school, you're not entitled to what Bonnie had talked about, a full IEP. You may be able to have something called a service plan, which is really a very small portion of special education. But when we think about vouchers and charter schools, we want to make sure that students who do have disabilities will have equal access to those private schools so that we're not looking at any discrimination.
Okay, let's take another call. And this is Chris in North Conway. Go ahead, Chris. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. I have a student who was diagnosed with ADHD and anxiety, so qualifies for a 504 plan. But in the course of assessment, he also completely capped out the intelligence testing. And the psychiatrist that performed his assessment made clear that he was really a gifted child. But when we started a conversation with our school about building a plan for him, we were told he didn't qualify for an IEP at all. His academic performance was more than adequate. He's an honor roll student. And so no additional measures could be taken to address the fact that this was a really advanced thinker. And the reason I was offered was that the state of New Hampshire does not make provisions for gifted children. So I just wondered if your panel could maybe address that issue of what we've heard termed as twice exceptional children. And I'm happy to take that offline.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chris, for the call. Anybody want to jump in on that?
Sure.
Bonnie?
First, if a child is gifted, whether that child has a disability or not, the school district may offer some special programs, some advanced placement courses or others. And if that child has a disability and needs accommodations, then the civil rights law, Section 504, would provide for that child to have those accommodations that they needed to have an equal opportunity to participate and benefit. And if a child has a disability and gets good grades, the federal law is very clear that having good grades does not exclude a child from receiving special education. That child may have needs that affect their ability to access other parts of the school experience that make them eligible for special education. So it's free appropriate public education, not free appropriate public academics. You look at education in the broader sense.
So your child can be incredibly bright and yet still qualify for an IEP?
Stephen Hawking would probably have an IEP if he were a child in New Hampshire today.
Got it. Okay, let's take another call. Trisha's in Merrimack. Hi, Trisha. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi.
Hi, Santina.
Hi, Trish.
I actually have a daughter who is a double E, twice exceptional. And she was actually on her way to being kicked out of preschool, which was how she got identified, because she had a difficult time just being in the environment. It wasn't her intellect. It was her sensitivities that were the issue. So she could read, but she couldn't stand in line for the restroom. So she ended up on an IEP, which was very fortunate early on. But at one point, I had a former school board member tell me, you know, you need to decide. Either your child is disabled or she's gifted, but she can't be both because that's double dipping.
That's really interesting. Kind of relates to what Bonnie just said. Do you want to jump in on that, Michael?
I do. When we can see the disability in front of us, it feels a little bit easier to get our hands around it, right? So we look at somebody like Stephen Hawking, as Bonnie mentioned. We see he needs a wheelchair. We see he needs a communication device. That feels like something that's actionable. Somebody presents with sensory sensitivities, and people ask, well, what does that mean?
Right, and what's your problem?
Right,
really?
So if you know, my tag in my shirt is really freaking me out and I'm jumping all over the room just to get the tag out of my shirt, then that's the support I need. Yet we have to attend to that too, which means we have to be more nuanced, more dedicated, more focused. And if my struggle is internally how I'm organizing my daily schedule. So I have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder myself. I have ADHD. And I need lots of organizational strategies in my day. My schools aren't necessarily going to see that, but they could see a difference in my performance when I'm supported with visual schedules and when I'm not. And that comparison is really important to figure out.
So without the support, they keep saying, Michael, why do you keep forgetting your homework?
There you go.
Michael, why do you keep, you know, not turning stuff in? And that's why. Bonnie, real quick.
Sure. I know Trish and I know her family. And with the right special education supports, if Trish, if you're still there, how's your daughter doing now?
Okay.
She's not still
yeah,
there.
Yeah.
She's amazing. She's taking graduate classes and in college and is on her way to having a fabulous adult life. But that wouldn't have happened without special education.
All right. Thank you for the call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email from Jen, and it's a little long, but it raises an important point, and I want to share it with you. Jen says, I agree that inclusive classrooms can be beneficial for all students to a point. I recently observed a second grade class where a child with autism and oppositional behavior acted out repeatedly during the math lesson, but the teacher and the student's aide kept negotiating with the child instead of holding him to the same standard of behavior as the rest of the students. He was allowed to roll around on the rug, even though he had been asked multiple times to sit in his special chair in the circle next to the teacher. The teacher told me after class that she often has to just ignore this disruptive behavior and try not to set him off rather than sending him out of the room because her administration wants her to focus on the positive. That's put in quotes. I don't see how this is benefiting any of the students, Jen says. If anything, the disruptive student is not paying attention and the other students are repeatedly interrupted. I know we want to provide the least restrictive environment, but least restrictive for whom? Jen says, I think the rule should be, quote, inclusive and less disruptive. Jen, thank you for the point. We've heard stories like this before. Inclusive is great unless it detracts from the experience of all the other kids. And Michael, I can see you're bursting to jump in, so go ahead. But I do want to hear from everybody.
I do want to jump in because behavior is the thing that gets kids ousted so often, more so than other issues, right? So if I'm using a wheelchair and I'm using a communication device and I'm very compliant in class, I may not be getting a thing out of the content, but everybody's happy with me being there. And here's a child who's maybe really engaged in the learning process and engaged in lots of other things in the classroom that are distracting or problematic. I can't comment on the specifics of that situation, Jen. It sounds like there are lots of nuances there, but I'll share a parallel story. I got a call once from a special education teacher supporting a second grade young girl, and she said, Michael, I need a pantsing program. And I was like, what do you mean you need a pantsing program? She said, well, Rachel's pantsing. And I did not understand what the heck pantsing was. Well, it turns out Rachel was standing up in the middle of class and pulling down her pants, which would be a little distracting to other people in the environment, which was her intent, was to get attention. When we went in and we did some systematic observations of what was happening for Rachel, part of what we learned about her is that she does really well when she's getting lots of personalized praise and attention, and she doesn't do well when she's not getting that personalized praise and attention. So two things have to happen there. One, we've got to teach Rachel some skills about how to manage in class when I'm not getting attention all
right,
the time.
Right, because you're not going to get that all the time.
And we want to provide in the interim, because we're the teachers, we're the grown-ups, and we can prevent the pantsing if we're giving her some extra praise. So we're going to do a both and I'm going to taper back on the praise as she builds her skill set. So what are the triggers? What are the things that are setting off the child's behavior? It needs to be 95% of the focus of our energy. How can we prevent the issue of this child rolling around in class, not being able to sit in their chair? Let's put our energy there and prevent it versus having to focus on the after fact, the aftermath, and the consequence. Well, now he's rolling. What do we do? Well, let's shift our attention back to what set this up.
It sounds like the teacher doesn't have the support he or she needs to prevent it. So then what does the teacher do, Bonnie?
Well, I heard a story from Jonathan Mooney, who speaks around the country about his experiences as a child with ADD and with learning disabilities. And he said for him as a child, one of the bright light bulb moments was when a teacher said, Jonathan, sit still and pay attention. And he realized, I can sit still or I can pay attention. I can't do both. And so for this child, is his need to roll, in order to pay attention, does he need to sit on the floor? Does he need to roll around on the floor? And if you're doing that behind other children, how distracting is it really? If he's screaming while he's doing it, that may be a different story. But to find out, is there a way to address his needs while minimizing the distractions? And the other is that children are sometimes less distracted than you might think. That's just Billy. That's just how he does. You know, we don't even notice. And so to really have somebody from the outside perhaps come in and look at the situation.
Well, so if Billy is rolling around on the floor, I don't know, maybe five other little boys say, hey, I want to roll around the floor too. And then you've got six little boys rolling around on the floor.
So?
I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of that teacher. It's kind of hard to teach when you've got six little boys rolling around on the floor.
I think in kindergarten or some of the earlier grades, that's not as uncommon for children to be moving around and doing things like that. Or it may be for that teacher. If you've got six little boys who need to roll on the floor, perhaps you're asking that whole group to sit still for far too long.
So again, look holistically at the classroom, Michael. That's what you'd say. But it does sound like this teacher needs more help.
More help, and I would go back to something that Santina mentioned when she referenced this thing called Universal Design for Learning, UDL. It's actually a framework for thinking about how we can shift up our teaching such that we're getting the broader variability in our classroom, right? So as Bonnie's raising the concern, well, what if the teaching is kind of shooting down the middle? Think about the bowling metaphor. We bowl right down the middle. There's a great video on YouTube that covers this in the field of teaching by Shelley Moore. And if you're bowling right down the middle, most often you end up with two side pins left. That's a 7-10 split. And what UDL asks us to do is to change our aim, which is what good bowlers do. They actually bowl on the curve. They aim for the 7-10 pins, and then that actually results in getting all the pins knocked down. So what if we shifted our preparation for our lessons in teaching? What if we changed our aim and actually aimed for the 7-10 split, the student who has the greatest need and the student who maybe needs the greatest academic challenge in order to be engaged in our lessons? If we aim for them, we'll actually still get all the rest of the pins. So stepping back, as Bonnie would say, and looking, what are the needs of all the students in my classroom, and what are the extremes? If I aim for those extremes, can I still get everybody else in this lesson?
Wow. It's a lot to think about, though.
Oh, yeah. Just a little bit there.
Yeah. Which when you've got 25 kids in front of you.
Which is presents the challenge, right? You can see why we need both leadership in schools to shift an entire culture to value diversity and variability. At the same time, we have to up our teaching game. And when I talk with teachers who actually include kids with more significant disabilities, what they say is, I've become a better teacher because now I'm stretching my professional skill set. I'm flexing those professional muscles to be able to reach to a farther place. And actually now I can successfully teach more students.
All right. Lots more we could have talked about. I want to thank all of you for being here. And Santina, thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Great. It was great to be here. Thank you.
That's Santina Thibodeau, New Hampshire State Director of Special Education. Bonnie Dunham, thank you also.
Thank you.
Bonnie Dunham is Associate Project Director at the New Hampshire Parent Information Center on Special Education. And Michael, thank you also for your time.
Appreciate it. Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Michael McSheehan, Project Director at the UNH Institute on Disability and Center on Inclusive Education. He also serves as Coordinator of Technical Assistance for the SWIFT Education Center. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.